Hey everybody, I'm Bobby Salveson.
And I'm Michael Monaco, and together we are the Hazmat Guys, connecting the Hazmat community near and far with knowledge, insight, and real-world examples in an effort to make your job just a little bit easier and safer.
Now, let's take a minute to hear from today's sponsors. Hey, Mike, pop quiz. What is the standard go-to method for emergency decon?
That's pretty easy. Wet decon, right?
Well, you know, you're not the only one that may be thinking that, but it's actually dry decon.
No. How many times have I heard dilution is the solution to pollution?
Actually, too many. And that's the issue. Makes sense if you think about it. Without the use of water, we don't need to spend extra time setting up traditional showers or pools, and there's no wastewater afterwards. And you're not going to freeze anybody to death if it's below 60 degrees.
Check out firstlinetech.com/drydecon. Firstline Technology has a whole webpage dedicated to the methodology and links to plenty of dry decon resources. See for yourself why dry decon with FiberTech should be your go-to immediate decon solution.
You know, it's time to rethink your level A protection. Multi-threat suits made of lightweight Gore Chempak Ultra Barrier Fabric are part of the most functional non-encapsulated level A ensembles that bring an essential modernization to hazmat PPE. Certified NFPA 1994 Class 1 suits with Gore Chempak Ultra Barrier Fabric offer unencumbered movement, increased range of motion, improved peripheral visibility, excellent dexterity, and reduced heat stress so you can stay engaged longer. You can learn more at GoreTexProfessional.com. Let's get to the show.
Good afternoon, evening, or morning to the Hazmat world out there. This is the Hazmat Guys podcast. I'm Michael Monaco, and I have with me, of course, as always, Bobby. And episode, what do we say? 356. I know it's amazing. Every time we say it, we're just in awe that, you know, people are still actually listening to us. But we have a chilling episode today. Before we get into it, Bob, what have you got?
Just see quick couple things. Become a specialist so you can come on. Actually, this show that we're talking about today, I pre-pitched to the brain trust, if you would, on the happy hour, and I gave them a little. And actually, oh man, they sent me some stuff. Now I have to look for this. They sent me the actual manual of how this whole thing works. So today's episode is partially brought to you by the Mind Trust at the Happy Hour. So if you're curious about what that is, go get your specialist. And it's going to be every fourth Thursday of the month, 1900 hours Eastern Standard Time. And you can find it at thehazmatguys.com/happy.
Will that manual be available in the premium content?
Oh, yes, it will.
Yes, it will. So that's all the more reason to get a subscription, because there is some premium content out there that you may want to be able to get your hands on. And it's a good time. Listen, the happy hour, it has functional use other than just people getting together talking. And that functional use bypasses all the social media policy nonsense that prevents us from being able to really talk to each other. Yes. This is because it is private. And it is not videotaped. So if and nothing ever leaves, it's like an AA meeting, right? Like what you hear here, what you see here, when you leave here, let it stay here. And we hold that very true to the happy hour. Whatever is talked about, whatever is said, everything stays anonymous. You know, the runs may be changed to protect the innocent, but I can guarantee you nothing you ever say will get you fired from social media.
No. And this is, it's a good place to be. So good stuff. This episode, this came across the old email, hopper. This came right from the old emailer, and, it was sent. And the guy that was sent us the email, it's not his verbiage, but he had some concerns. And he says, read this email and give me your thoughts. And I actually know the guy, so I actually made the phone call. And it turned out to be quite the lengthy call, because there was a lot to be discussed about this thing. And some liability things. So let's start with this. There was a rather large food chain in a town somewhere at a time sometime.
Okay. So our Anywhereville, Anytimeville yes. with the local Anywhere Fire Department.
Right. And okay. They got called there for an automatic fire alarm, right? So the automatic fire alarm goes off. For some reason, they start evacuating the stores and the companies start coming on scene and they start making their way in.
Did they start evacuating the stores because the fire alarm went off? I'm just trying
I think
to.
I'm, so.
Okay. Because usually we arrive on scene. If there's no smoke, we're not pushing people out of the doors.
I don't know what their policy was. I don't know if people were evacuated because the bells and the gongs were going off,
okay,
or whatever it was, or they saw smoke or whatever it might be at this point in the story. I'm going to assume that people were leaving.
Okay.
I would think, right? And what it turned out to be was a activation of the CO2 alarm.
Ooh. Okay, so something that we're all pretty familiar with, CO2, we see it in beverage centers.
Yes. Right?
A lot of times people are doing cryogenic CO2 in soda dispensers, and these things are not really well maintained, and we have liquid CO2 leaks relatively frequently.
Right, and that's good information to get out there, because if you have a occupancy that has high volume, like, because they're not going to do it if they're only throwing, you know, 30 drinks at the front, like a pizza store, right, or something like that. You're talking about McDonald's, guys that are throwing 5,000-6,000, you know, drinks, you know, a week out, then it's beneficial for them to get liquefied carbon dioxide.
Right.
Because it's just more bang for the buck. You just get it in a condenser.
So does this supermarket push that kind of volume in drinks?
No, not at all. Zero.
Okay,
that's point one.
That's a little odd.
But again, and in this email, it says that, you know, that they have been called there in the past for minor activations or minor leaks of the CO2 leaking. So in my mind, I'm sitting there going, oh, there's no CO2 in this place. What the hell are they talking about, right? So he goes through how the standard four gas does not have a CO2 sensor. It has a CO sensor. Right. I like that. He's kind of sending this email out as an FAQ, like a, hey, listen, just as a pass it on program kind of thing. Hey, listen, here's a little bit of, you know, gems for you to smoke on, whatever you want.
Talking specifically about CO2. So I'm sorry. I'm trying to stay along with you.
Right.
Is he coming from the point of view of there is a chemical activating the CO alarm and it's being cross sensitive on our meters?
They have a CO2 meter in the building.
Okay.
And that the people jumping off the rigs with their standard four gas is for CO,
yes,
not CO2.
Yes.
Two different things.
Yes.
Good. I like that information. And where would you find if your only tool is your four gas, how would you pick up CO2 in air?
You'd be picking it up with an oxygen displacement, but have to be extraordinarily careful because there is oxygen drift on the sensors, so they don't really actually start being accurate until about 0.2% displacement of O2. So you really have to, you know, you have to understand that there's a very big margin of error in very small amounts of gas. What we would consider small amounts to start that 0.1 movement of O2 on the meter.
But that would be the only thing you'd see. You see a depression in an oxygen due to the CO2 taking up the space, right?
Right.
Okay, great. So I'm going to quote this one part here. As I advanced deeper into the building and the visibility decreased, despite no readings on the meter.
With the visibility decreased?
Yes.
Oh.
See, now I'm sitting going, what the hell is he talking about?
Okay.
Why would the visibility be going down? Right? The decision was made to go on air. I like that. Healthy. I love it. Even because if something, you know, even though my meter's not saying something, if my spidey senses are tingling, just go on air. It's free. Yeah,
well,
go.
Your senses are a meter as well.
Totally.
Right. So
I like
if I see something in the air, if I see it in the air, I'm breathing it into my lungs.
Right.
So yes, 100%.
realizing if conditions were this bad, this far away from the source, they had to be much worse, closer to the source. Okay.
Reasonable.
I'm still tracking with you. It's reasonable. Okay. So now, as they start making their way to the mechanical refrigeration area, which is, I guess, on the second floor of like the butcher's area.
Okay. So like the plenum.
Yes. Okay. And now I'm sitting going, okay, maybe they have a refrigeration, but, and I, this is a side note, I have personally never heard of a carbon dioxide refrigeration system. I've heard of all types of refrigerants. I've never heard of CO2 being used in this fashion. So immediately I was kind of like, I was talking to one guy and I was like, you know, before I call anybody a liar, I got to go see this thing with my own eyes. And so I made the pilgrimage over there to see this. And I do have some pictures we'll show in a couple of minutes for you, you premium members, that you're going to see it on the screens, looking at these plenums on your face here.
Beautiful. Beautiful faces. Now with hair.
So, all right, so as they made their way up, there was nearly zero visibility.
What?
And they can hear a hissing sound from leaking upstairs. At the top of the stairs, the door was shut. Shut, and they cracked the door open, and they stuck the meter in, and it immediately dropped down to 16.4 on the O2.
Okay, so they do have a C. What you're saying is they absolutely 100% had a CO2 leak in the refrigeration system.
Right.
Yes.
It's now okay. I understand this. I track on this. When I went to go look at this, this is a gaseous only CO2 system.
Ooh, under high pressure?
They must be doing it, and that's where we're going to show you some of those schematics and those diagrams, is that they had no capability of holding anything more than a very small amount of liquid because of the way the system works.
Okay, so right now I've got two different opposing thoughts in my head, and they got nothing on their PID.
No.
Okay, so the reason...
Well, I don't think they have a PID.
Okay.
I don't think that would make the move anyway. The visibility for a gas system.
Here's my thought, right, is that sometimes when we have a massive leak of refrigerants, the refrigerants and the lubricants are also often in the same system. So when we have that massive displacement, it atomizes the lubricants, and we will pick up very small readings on our PID. But that often, I've never been to a leak where there was zero visibility.
Right.
Right. That's the part that's crazy. Now, on the other hand, if you were saying, okay, this is a liquid system, then I would say, okay, no problem. The massive cold air with the, is it in a very humid climate?
Yeah, it's in the northeast, we'll say.
Okay, so mixed in with the humidity can cause a fog, very similar to like dry ice, how dry ice gives off a fog. Mm-hmm. So that would have been my other thing, but I can't necessarily pinpoint where this zero visibility is coming from. And if it's not that big of a system, I mean, supermarkets are huge areas, and even the plenum and the mechanical room are big volumes of area.
Yes.
What the hell are we talking about?
Yes. So, you know what? I'm going to switch over, and we're going to take a look at the some pictures we have here. This was the compressor, and it clearly, and I'm saying that this system has been installed, I'm going to say, for maybe 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
And it is very well kept, obviously. It is clean and it is well maintained. It's spray painted, for those that can see, with R744 is spray painted on the side of the compressor pumps that are in series. And when you look up R744, it is indeed carbon dioxide.
Okay.
So the refrigerant is carbon dioxide. Got it. No problem. And if you look on, this is basically the whole system, and you can see that there are certain, I guess it would be compression and holding tanks. This is the high pressure side and the low pressure side. And this is where, through that pressure change. It's able to suck in heat and actually able to dispel heat to the radiators out, you know, to get rid of the heat. That's how the whole system
works. So it's not using phase change. It's just using compression thermodynamics.
Yes. That's as far as I read it. Yes, that is true. Right.
I'm shocked.
That's what I said. Now, this, I didn't take this picture quite for the thermostat that is in the photo. But if you look at the bottom of the top rail, you see like a drippy drip kind of humid condensation on there.
Yes.
The whole room had a fine sheen of oil.
Ah.
So if this was indeed a liquid carbon dioxide leak, there would be no residue.
Right.
Period. It would be gone.
Right.
If it was an aerosolization of lubricants propelled by either the low or the high side of that CO2, and the CO2 was literally the propellant throwing an aerosolization of lubricant, then you would see this.
Yep. Yep. And so, you touched it and felt it, and it was
greasy.
Oil.
It was like, yep. I need some paper towels up here. So the email goes on, and this isn't, I'm not poking fun at the guy that wrote this thing. He does a pretty good job of doing the math and explaining how this five times the displacement, you know, when you have 1% difference on the oxygen sensor, it's actually five times it because you're moving oxygen. We've done this ad nauseum. Everybody understands it. And he goes in it, but he specifically is going in assuming that vapor cloud that was seen was carbon dioxide. And so he goes in. So he says that the CDC recognizes the IDLH of carbon dioxide to be 40,000 parts per million. I think it's 5,000.
I think it's 5,000. It's 50,000.
50.
I'm pretty sure the NIOSH is 50,000.
Yes, I agree. So this is part of my little, where I had a little problem, is he says, yesterday we were well into the IDLH atmosphere. To be more accurate, it was a deadly atmosphere inside an enclosed room.
Okay, well, yes, I do agree with him on that. Because
I agree too.
Okay.
But let me put on my my Chiefs hat or my law hat or my SOG hat or whatever hat you want to put on. If you're saying this, let's say you're in a department, you're in department ABC, and you have 200 guys all operations level.
Okay.
So I would say, it'd be a very, very, very strong argument saying your department operates as a defensive operations level department.
Yes.
Now they employ Mike and Bob, two specialists that are there. We're not on the same call. Let's say Mike goes to this call. Okay. And you're there as a specialist trained guy.
Okay. So I am, just to make sure we're clear on the law,
mm-hmm.
right? If I am a New York City firefighter, with a hazmat specialist background, hired by the New York City Fire Department to be a hazardous materials specialist.
Yep.
Let's say I volunteer out on one of the local departments out by me on Long Island.
Sure.
When I am operating under their AHJ, I am nothing more than operations level person.
Right. Even with all your training.
Even with all my training. I am not covered by them. I'm not certified by them. And I don't have any training through them. I have no authority to act as a technician under them.
Right.
Okay.
So if you're operating in this capacity, you put yourself in his shoes and you say that statement that yesterday we were well into an IDLH atmosphere, would you consider an offensive or defensive operation? Hey, listeners, the Hazmat Guys have some great news for you and your organization. We are really stepping up our brand of in-person training in addition to the great content you get on demand. Now, we know what you're thinking, but this is already incredibly great stuff, and how could it possibly get better? All I can say is wait until we're in front of you. When we gather the best of the best from across this planet and even beyond and assemble an instructional cadre that is seriously second to none. And now we have a ton of ways to help you, your team, or your organization get to a level that makes everybody proud. From subscriptions, on-demand, hybrid methods to full in-person goodness. You can contact me, Bob, at thehazmatguys.com to schedule a call and find a solution that works for you. And every participant of an in-person class gets a free one-year premium subscription, which sounds pretty good. So contact me at Bob at thehazmatguys.com and get some more information.
Oh, okay. So I am going to have to ask what his reason for being in that situation is, right? Because we have a couple things that we've learned on this podcast. When it comes to gases, fire departments, the line is very thin when it comes to things that operations levels have been trained in, right? Because I forget who we had on the show because I'm horrible with names. He's a very good friend, and I really should be remembering his name right now. He was talking about gas leaks because I think I asked, like, because I said, well, under that, under what you're talking about, then technically isn't a fire department walking in, shutting off somebody's gas leak an offensive operation? Do you remember that conversation?
Yes.
And he said, no, because it's something that is so pertinent and is done so much, and you are wearing all the appropriate equipment, and it's a gas, and there's really no hazard beyond the that can't be mitigated, or not mitigated, but defended against with the gear that you have on, with the bunker gear and SCBA. There's no reason for chemical protective clothing. There's no reason for CPC. And it is, you can be in the product at those levels because you're wearing equipment that you've already been trained with at the operations level.
I like it.
Okay. So that's my first thought. That's my first thought. So in my head, if they're going in there because there is a need to make sure there is nobody in that room.
Life, et cetera. Yeah, right. Absolutely.
Then, yes, you can be in there because – and you recognize that you needed to be on air. You could technically, if you look up CO2, I mean, you could be naked with an SCBA on. And you're in
totally
proper
good
protective gear, right? You're just protecting your respiratory system. It's just oxygen displacement.
Does say birthday suit approved.
Yes, 100%. I would prefer some kind of like Crocs or flip flops.
Absolutely.
Just to protect the feet. But yes, totally naked is fine. And so now you're still performing. You're in the gas. Yes, you're in the product. You're technically coming in contact with the product, but you're doing it for life safety purposes.
And once life safety has been proven, there's nobody there.
That's when
it starts getting blurry.
Yes, but what are they staying there for? Like, did they stay there in the area? Like, now it's like, okay, well, what about the defensive operation of ventilation? So now I'm opening doors and clearing the path.
Right. No, I'm not. Yeah, exactly. And it says a quick search of the room for the employees was done, and also attempting to open the double doors for vent and then exit the room and shut the door once again. So, yes, they were in there and they came out.
OK.
The member that sent this to me said, all right, let's say somebody in his partner is two in, two out, or an employee, or somebody got a hold of this email and said, I got injured and somebody worked outside their title.
Nobody,
and they wrote it down.
Nobody worked outside their title.
Being a technician for an operations department.
Yeah, but what was the function that he did that was offensive?
I think I read it already. Didn't I say it?
Because everything you described to me sounds like it's operations level.
Made to this nearly zero visibility, and it could be heard with the hissing sound. So they knew there was a problem.
Right.
They're moving up to the top of the stairs. Door was shut. They cracked the door. They stuck the meter in.
Right.
They were notified that there was nobody up there via radio.
Okay.
Then they entered to do another search.
Which I personally think is 100% okay.
I would do that too.
I would not believe anything that came over the radio. There's been more than enough times where I've been told a situation is X and it turns out to be Y. Right?
Yeah.
And as an incident commander, would you not want your guys in that room?
Do a secondary. That's why we do secondaries. Yeah.
We even don't even trust our own guys. We have other guys go in and do it. We don't even trust ourselves. We're going to freaking trust like a supermarket employee to be like, no, there's nobody in that room.
Yeah, it's nothing more than like, could the department be liable if there was an injury because it was written down that we went offensive. And I think that's a good argument. I think it could, because it was put on paper.
Right. I think you would have to. All right. So, and I'm not like a lawyer, but we have gone through OSHA and regulations pretty extensively. So the little bit that my unlawyer answer would be, if you were actually performing a technician level thing and you got hurt and the fire department instructed you to do so, then there is liability on that AHJ.
What if the member himself took it upon himself
then
to go in?
I think the AHJ can turn around and say, you weren't ordered to do that. You were freelancing. You went outside the bounds.
Yeah. See, this, it's not, I'm not poking fingers at anybody. I'm just saying that when you do one of these pass it on type programs, or you put out a document such as this, as innocuous and as innocent as you may think it is, at least one or two other people should look at these things, because somebody would be like, wait a second. This could open us up to liabilities here.
Oh, my God. Everything should be passed through a real lawyer. Like if
like a real person.
Yeah, no. And like if you are going to create, absolutely. Now listen, I've never been at the chief's level. Bob, you've been at the chief's level. I've been at officer levels. So I haven't ever gotten to the point that I was, you know, running a department.
Right.
But am I wrong in thinking that when a fire department, when a chief's office decides to come up with an SOP, that they're running it past a lawyer?
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. Okay.
Yeah, you have to. Like, everything has to get looked at. Like, even the math on the math. Like, if you're doing this math work, like, and he does a pretty good job. He explains it, you know, it's 1%, it's 5%, and then, you know, with the drops and stuff. Even me, I'd be like, Mike, look this over. Just make sure my math's right. Because you don't want to look like a jerk either.
Right. Yeah, I would think that if a member did something, and again, I'm just thinking, I don't know for sure, but I would imagine if I was in a fire, I'm thinking of a buddy of mine just recently, was in a fire, had his gloves off, fire pushed down from the attic unexpectedly, flashed over him, burnt the hell out of his hands.
Okay.
It's not the fire department's fault that his PPE was removed. Right, it's not like the chief ordered him to go in without his gloves off.
Right, it's written,
right, and he technically should know that where he is operating and he should stay in. Very similar to a paramedic that would be hired as an EMT in another department who hurts somebody performing ALS tasks.
Right.
Right. If the fire department had clear rules against it and did not order that person to go above his said title, for the most part, they're going to be not without liability. And I'm sure in this day and age, somebody's going to be like, well, technically they are still. But I could definitely see an argument where the department's like, no, you stepped outside your purview. You have the education to know what is offensive, what is defensive. You did that on your own. We're not taking responsibility for you getting hurt. You shouldn't have done that.
Right. And that's the point of the thing is, like, you know, there has to be a couple of different people. You want the technicians to look at it from their lens. You want the chiefs to look at it from their lens. You want, you know, a lawyer to look at it from their lens. And when it passed the sniff test from all these angles, these types of emails and documents can be very beneficial to the majority of the fire department, because there is good information here. It is a good way to catalog and take stock and move the ball forward for a department. But you also may write something in here that inadvertently, innocently, opens the entire department, and specifically to the AHJ, to a liability that is unintended.
So what was the policy that was, I must have missed this part. What is the policy that is under critique? Because was he following a policy, or was he not? Like, is he saying, hey, the fire department is telling me to do something that is beyond defensive operation?
I think it was just a, you know, hey, listen, pass it on kind of thing. But, you know, there is no written policy that anybody should pass it up the food chain for it to be distributed. It just, it doesn't come from Joe Fineman. You know, it gets approved by somebody that's up the chain, and they say, yes, you can send it out on behalf of yourself or on behalf of this office or whatever. It never comes from Joe.
Right.
You know, and so when Joe just takes it on himself to send something like this out, because it went through the department's, or, you know, email system, it almost becomes like ordained now. It's like it's part of the doctrine now.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I would imagine, as a chief or an officer, you have to be careful with the information, right? And we do this even in our training. In fact, we were just having a conversation with an entity that wanted us to come in and talk about proper storage and handling of lithium ion batteries. Huh. Right. So, and I had to be really clear with her that we can't do that.
Yeah.
Like, we can't do that because there isn't even governmental guidelines, OSHA guidelines, NFPA guidelines on proper handling and storage. So when we go into, and that was just an example, I don't freaking want to talk about lithium ion batteries, that's for sure. but when we go in to teach, right, correct me if I'm wrong, Bob, but we never say, this is what you should do.
No.
We say, here is the harm, here are the potentials, here is your cause and effect, and we will train you to mitigate in certain ways, but you're choosing how to figure this out, right? We're there to impart the knowledge for you to figure out how to make it work, but we don't tell you, you have to operate like this. That's
right.
That's up to the authority having jurisdiction.
Yep, I agree. So just for everybody to kind of like throw it on the table about a simple situation like this that went in a different direction than I actually thought.
Yeah. And it plays to what you always say, Bob, right? Like, you can't play the game unless you know the rules.
Right.
Right. So you can't just dip your toe in the regulations water without having read EPA, OSHA, NFPA, all of NFPA's, you know, force. I mean, right now it's all condensing down to a single document, but, you know, the everything that lands within our preview, there's a lot, there's an awful lot to unpack when you start looking into rules, regulations, even coming to training and response and equipment that's carried and training that is required for the equipment. Yeah, I have to say, with that said, we will start to see CO2 refrigerants becoming the mainstream type refrigerants, right? All the other hydrogenated, fluorinated and chlorinated hydrocarbons are becoming very, very expensive. And CO2 is a very cheap, effective way, right? One of these things pop, they just put in more CO2, which, whatever, you can get it 7-Eleven, you know, like it's right. It's everywhere. So you are seeing more of that. I would like to comment, though, they really, if you have a 5-gas, you really should consider having a PID with you. You know, if you're going to be making decisions on IDLH type environment, a PID I personally think, even at an operations level, is a fundamental piece of equipment that should be had, because the moment you start to get hits on your PID, you should be masking up, because you don't know what it is, but you know it's in the air. You know it's a volatile organic compound. Well, I shouldn't say that specifically, but you know it has it. You know there's something in the air. So if you've got a typical four gas meter, consider putting a PID on it. And goddamn it, there is no reason in this day and age that every single defensive and offensive operation out there shouldn't have a CO2 meter.
All right, we're going to take it to the premium, and we're going to go over a couple of things on the system of this type. So we'll see you. Well, that wraps up another episode of the Hazmat Guys. You can find us at Facebook, Twitter, and our YouTube channel. And don't be afraid to use that like or follow button. Or
you can sign up for even more content from us at thehazmatguys.com. Here, you can subscribe so that we can connect you to even more great stuff. Your support is going to help us improve and build this awesome community even more.
Yeah, and if you want to get to the next level, you won't want to miss our premium content. Our specialist level provides you with access to our entire catalog of shows, which is now over 300, an exclusive Facebook group, premium video with no ads, and so much more. Also, check the Hazmat Guys University link on our website.
And don't forget, we are always interested in hearing about incidences or calls that you have experienced. We may bring you on the show to share that story. Reach us at feedback@thehazmatguys.com.
And remember, folks, don't just get on the job, get into the job.